Good morning. It is Sunday, September 22nd, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellum. Support for KUAF comes from Edible Ozarks, Arkansas. Launching later this month, this quarterly magazine focuses on food, farms, and culture in the Ozarks. Proceeds will benefit hunger relief efforts through Feed Fayetteville and Feed Communities. More information, including subscriptions, available at edibleozarkansas.com.
The KUAF website giveaway is offering passes to the Yonder Mountain String Band's Harvest Music Festival. It takes place October 17th through the 19th in Ozark. Performers include Les Claypool's Duo De Twang, Green Sky Bluegrass, Justin Town Earl, and others. Workshops, various vendors, and outdoor activities will be offered. The drawing is Friday, October 4th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration is available at KUAF.com.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, a student-led sex education week, two brothers who make canoes in Avoca, and we step inside Sun's Chapel near Goshen.
But first, most of us expect it to be there when we want it, and even get frustrated when it doesn't work properly or fast enough. The internet. According to a report last month by the Pew Research Center, 20% of Americans aren't connected at all, with Arkansas ranked 48th in the nation for people with access to the internet. I spoke with potential stakeholders about how this affects the education of Arkansans and possible measures to remove the barriers to connectivity. According to last spring's TEDx Fayetteville talk by Rebecca Miles and Javier Reyes, 30% of Americans complete a four-year college degree in 4 years, yet just 20% of Arkansans do the same. And just 14% of Arkansans have a college degree. More and more people are forced to get college degrees whether they want to or not. It's now the barrier to obtaining most professional careers, says Dr. Rebecca Miles.
If I have children or I live in a small town where I can't move to get a college degree, I'm not able to get that degree that allows me either entry to a job or a better salary to the job that I want to have. Technology allows people, if we put all the pieces together, to stay in their hometown and still get that same college degree without having to move to Fayetteville or wherever else they might want to move. So it allows me to learn, move ahead, keep pace with my peers both locally and nationally if I have access and get the education that I want.
Miles is a management professor at the University of Arkansas. There's also a direct correlation between education and economic development. It starts with education, providing a base for entrepreneurship and setting up new jobs and allowing individuals to recognize opportunities. Dr. Javier Reyes is the Vice Provost for Distance Education at the University of Arkansas's Global Campus.
Being now that we have the technology to disseminate education through online media in a way that it's effective, that has the quality that you want to have, and now it can have the reach that you currently couldn't have with a face-to-face environment, that is what the correlation is. You're going to be able to have a higher number of educated population in order to be able to have a higher impact in economic development. Now, it's not only about the four-year degree, it's not only about the associate's degree, it's also about certificate, it's also about training programs. So that's what I think it's the correlation that exists between more technology, more connectivity, and have a highly educated population.
For Miles, education means three things. If one has a college education, they are more likely to encourage their kids to go, a sort of pay it forward. Second, a more educated population can understand complicated documents better, laws, real estate papers, and when voting, it helps to understand the issues, so educated people can make more informed decisions, whether personal or public.
And then the third one is it would make me happy if people would look at Arkansas potential employers not just as a vast wasteland of near the bottom educated people, but look at those folks in Arkansas. They have beautiful land, they have lots of land, and they care about how educated their citizens are. So if I move my company there, I'm partnering with those folks in order to have a highly educated workforce.
There is a difference between connectivity and accessibility. Reyes says there are three barriers to accessibility.
Is there no connectivity because the end user doesn't have access to an internet connection, or they have access but they don't have the income to pay for it, or they may have access, the income, but they're not aware of the benefits? So it's about finding which one of these three is really the barrier and why we're not connected in, when we look at national rankings.
It's different for everybody, and Reyes says that in some places it's a combination of the three. In some areas of Arkansas, say the Delta, where connectivity is low, awareness is low, and incomes are low. It is difficult to raise awareness as to how the internet could be a benefit. For many jobs in this day and age, you have to apply online. If you aren't connected, you don't even know the jobs are there. For Reyes, awareness is the biggest barrier.
It's about what is the benefit of having an email account? What is the awareness, or what is the benefit of having the awareness of how to navigate the internet? What is it for? So, and when you see the kids now, even in the schools, in the K-12 system, what they're learning, how they're learning, how they can in a day build a report from a painting that it's at the Louvre in Paris, and you can get a virtual tour of the Louvre online. That kind of creativity, that kind of, it's opening their minds. And if we don't have that in our state, we keep falling behind and more and more and more. That we need to get that access. We need to make sure that people see what is the benefit. We need to raise awareness of how important that is to create the young minds and create the really the culture of having more innovation, more technology embedded in our everyday lives, so we can start really making the machinery run again at the speed that other states and other nations are running.
He says that it cannot be done with just universities. It needs to be a combination of the private sector and the public sector, and not just in higher education. The report card on American education from the American Legislative Exchange Council ranks Arkansas's public schools at 45th in the nation. Governor Mike Beebe sees the relation between connectivity and education, evidenced by the start of a task force, Faster Arkansas. Faster, fast access for students, teachers, and economic results. It's a group of business leaders, technical experts, and political experts trying to push forward broader and faster internet access in all of the public schools in Arkansas. Jerry Jones, an executive vice president with Axiom in Little Rock, is chair of the group.
It was our collective belief, certainly the belief of the governor, that even though Arkansas had gotten off to a good start back in 1992, it would fall in way behind. And it was time for us not just to catch up, but to get ahead. And so hence he asked me to bring this group together. We're meeting regularly. We're divided into various subcommittees. And hopefully by the end of this calendar year, we will have a set of very, very specific recommendations on the governor's desk that hopefully will be persuasive to him to go to the special session of the legislature that's primarily the financial session of the legislature in January and February and adopt whatever changes in Arkansas law need to be adopted to move forward.
Jones says Faster Arkansas is looking at the speeds and capacity levels that should be adopted by schools. He referenced a Cisco report that recommends in 5 years, students should have access to a 2 gigabyte per second capacity in order to have a functioning school. He says Arkansas can't do that initially. While there are some small rural districts with no broadband access at all, larger districts don't have sufficient capacity to support all of the needed online usage. Often, not everyone that needs on can get on. It will also be a problem when Common Core standards are enacted next year. Testing will be completed via the internet, and Arkansas will not be able to comply with the standards without more capacity. Faster will start with the schools, but want to make sure that what they do can be utilized by communities, which is where the ER in the name comes from, economic results.
Our strategy is, first, we're going to focus on the school districts and the school buildings, and we're going to make suggestions there, and we're going to try to drive some very, very rapid change there because we got to catch up. Coming in on top of that is, what can the state of Arkansas do to help make sure that the internet is ubiquitous, that you have access to the internet at a reasonable price. It's not going to be free, but at a reasonable price anywhere within the state of Arkansas. One of the benefits that we have in making this effort right now is that the cost of technology is going down instead of up in this respect when you think of the amount of accessibility and capacity. So this is the beginning of a longer-term strategy. It's a continuum of efforts. We can't solve everything on day one, but hopefully we can start helping make the decisions that are necessary to have the proper guidelines, policy, and strategy.
Helping to get internet access to rural citizens is Ron Grigg of Deluxe Information Systems in Springdale. For 11 years, he has been providing broadband through links and towers around the region, sending out 2.5 gigahertz, which is higher than an AM-FM broadcast, from 65 locations such as Mount Kessler, Mount Sequoia, and Robinson Mountain, to about 700 customers who didn't have any other option for internet access.
It's too expensive for Cox or AT&T to run fiber or coax out into a low-density area. And so, they focus on towns and communities, but people that live off out. And I mean, I've got clients that are 5-10 miles away from my towers, and the primary requirement is to have a clear line of sight and be able to see the tower with the antenna they're connecting with. And so I'm not able to reach everybody, but anybody that's got a clear view to one of my tower locations has got the chance of getting some good broadband.
Companies charge customers that want access about $10 per foot of cable that needs to be laid, way out of the budget for most people. Grigg agrees that it is important for people to have access for education, work, and even safety.
Well, the biggest thing is school. You know, the school children have to have it anymore for doing their schoolwork, submitting schoolwork, getting their grades, communications between the parents and the teachers. A lot of people have started working from home to save all the driving. So there's a world of information there at your fingertips, and you can connect anywhere in the world.
Bringing internet to rural customers can be likened to events of 75 to 80 years ago, when homes that never had light were wired for electricity. Here's Dr. Miles and Dr. Reyes.
We did not think that electricity was a public good. And perhaps it's time to think about internet access as a public good.
And the truth is, sometimes we have to understand that the cost of making it available will not necessarily be paid by the kids who are getting access now. But once they're in, the benefit that society and that these areas will see in the coming years, it's what we have to figure out how to do it, how to make sure that we take the return on investment, the present value of that return investment, and really cost it out today.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Many student-led organizations and events on the University of Arkansas campus, but this week, one of a different nature will take shape, Sex Education Week. Antoinette Grajeda spoke with the student leaders, and she has this report.
According to the Arkansas Department of Health, the state does not require sex education for students. If sex education is taught, it must stress sexual abstinence, and any other content is left to the discretion of the local school district. Because sex education is not required in the state, students for gender equality at the University of Arkansas have decided to help educate their peers. Monday will mark the start of Smart and Sexy Sex Education Week. Andrea Love, co-president of the group, says the inaugural Sex Education Week was organized last spring and received a positive response.
In the spring, we decided that we wanted to have some sort of event around sex ed, and it turned into a whole week because we had so many different topics that we wanted to address. And so that was in February, the first time that we held it of this year. And so we had an amazing turnout. About 300 different people came to our events over the week, and people loved it and gave us like really good feedback. And so we were excited and we wanted to do it again. And we thought that we might as well start in the fall and sort of try to market it more toward new students and freshmen especially, who probably haven't had really any of this before, and who are kind of thrown into a new environment where there is a lot of pressure to start being sexually active without much knowledge or resources about how to do that safely and in a healthy way.
The Gender Studies Department is sponsoring the week-long event that kicks off Monday with a screening of the film Straight-Laced, How Genders Got Us All Tied Up. Andrea says in addition to basic health classes, events throughout the week will address issues of sexuality, sexual orientations, gender identities, and how gender plays into sex. The event has been organized by students, and Andrea says they wanted to control the content of Sex Education Week because they themselves are students, and as such, they understand what other students want and need as far as resources. Jody Nimmo, co-president of Students for Gender Equality, says while the group is organizing the event, they are not giving any of the presentations. The group has been able to find specialists within their own personal networks to talk about each subject.
We have a pretty great group of sexually liberated and informed friends that we can call upon for awesome events such as this one.
But other people, like the person doing bystander intervention for us, approached us, which was really great, and it was a new addition to this fall's presentation. And then the blogger who's speaking is somebody that I had read their blog for a long time and knew that they lived in Fayetteville, and so I contacted them, and they were really excited to participate.
The bystander intervention session is scheduled for Tuesday, following a program that focuses on treating pain with sex. Wednesday's events include a session on rape culture and two panel discussions, one on polyamory and a second on trans and gender identity. All events will take place on the U of A campus except for the Climax, a Friday night event for those 18 and up at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street. Andrea says it will be a fun and less formal way to end the week. It will feature music, speakers, discussions she says are a little more appropriate for an outside venue, as well as giveaways. Jody Nimmo, co-president of the group, says the event will also mark the launch of a new initiative called the Condom Squad. She says it's important for students to have access to resources like condoms, especially for those living in co-ed environments.
We came up with the idea for the Condom Squad as, I don't know, it kind of makes me feel like a superhero. And we decided that we would make badges of some sort, or buttons or pins, or some sort of visible signal that says to someone, if you need a resource and you see this badge on my backpack, then you can come and ask me for it. And if I don't have it, then I'll make sure that you get it. And we'd like to get as many people involved in this as we can. We've talked to some other RSOs to see if they would like to partner with us. We've had some good response there. We want to get some of the residents, some of the RAs to keep them on hand in the dorms if we can get them involved. I think that'd be really wonderful.
Andrea Love, co-president of Students for Gender Equality, says one of the reasons the week features a broad range of topics is because she is approaching the subject from a critical perspective.
You know, you can just give people condoms and say, here, like, be safe. But I think a lot more goes into how we talk about sexuality and how we think about sexuality. And, you know, we are Students for Gender Equality. We're very interested in gender issues and how that affects everything. And so, you know, I think we really, since sex ed is so lacking in our schools, and since we are suffering because of it, I mean, Arkansas has atrocious rates of STDs and teen pregnancy. And so, you know, that path isn't working. And so I think to sort of fill that gap, we really need comprehensive sex ed. And in our minds, comprehensive means a bunch of different things that these students probably haven't been exposed to before, including, you know, what it's like to be a transgender person, or what it's like to live as a polyamorous family, which I think is still on the cutting edge of most discussions, not even those in the South.
According to a 2011 report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Arkansas has the 8th highest rate of gonorrhea out of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. According to a recent study by the Guttmacher Institute that uses data from 2008, Arkansas has the 5th highest rate of teen pregnancy in the country. Regardless of what event students attend, Brady Larson, secretary and treasurer of Students for Gender Equality, hopes they will become more at ease discussing the topic.
It's okay to talk about these subjects and these topics. It's not something to be scared of or to be nervous about. That would be the main thing that I would hope everyone would take away from it.
Something that I hope people might take away is that, you know, this is information that can last you a lifetime. It's about your health. It's about, you know, just another part of your health. It's kind of controversial, though it shouldn't be. So there are some folks out there who, are not planning to be sexually active for a while, this information is still valuable. So I guess I would just hope that, have an open mind and you'll probably learn something.
Smart and Sexy Sex Education Week begins Monday and is free and open to the public. More information is available at uarkgender.wordpress.com.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda filed that report for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Later today on This American Life, it is a very popular drug. Every week, one out of six Americans take some. I'm talking about acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol. And it also kills more people than any other over-the-counter painkiller. Over 150 Americans die each year, on average, from accidentally taking too much, according to the federal government. It takes a lot less to endanger you than you may know. Later today.
This American Life, just ahead this morning at 10 o'clock here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Once a month, we find a spot in our area where ingenuity or entrepreneurship or both has taken root. Our locally made series highlights people creating all manner of objects. And this week, that hunt for locally made objects took us to rural Benton County, outside of Avoca, to meet one of the two siblings behind the company Two Brothers Canoe Incorporated. Generally, people buy canoes to get away from the noise of the city. Well, just getting to the shop where Two Brothers Canoes are created takes you away from the noise already.
Yeah, we're in the sticks a little bit. And, you see the sign up front on the road? That just went up today.
The sign Lewis Shaw is talking about is for the dirt road that leads to his shop. His neighbors began a petition to have the road officially called Canoe Lane. Lewis grew up not far from here, about 5 miles as the crow flies, around Prairie Creek. And he grew up fishing, floating, and boating on area rivers and lakes. But he didn't grow up thinking he wanted to make the canoes he used. That came years later. His older brother Bill, who lives in Missouri and is in the manufacturing business, was the first to get the idea. So in hindsight, the development of Two Brothers Canoe seems to make sense. You take one brother.
I've always loved canoeing and being on the rivers around here.
Plus another brother.
My brother has been in the production and manufacturing for 20 plus years, and he had a fiberglass company.
And voila, you have a small canoe manufacturing business. Well, not quite. Lewis says a few years ago at a family gathering, his older brother asked him a question seemingly out of the blue.
I was talking about a canoe trip. I just went on a spring, lots of water, and he kind of came up to me after I was done with my story and said, "Hey, you want to make canoes?" I'm like, "Make canoes?" He's like, "Yeah, we can make canoes." I'm like, "Well, sure."
A bit later, Lewis says he was writing a check for some heavy equipment, and he realized, hey, he was in the canoe business, or at least would be soon. His shop is in a spot that is about as isolated as you can be in a growing Benton County. Directions to the shop include the instruction to turn left at the crushed culvert. But his shop is filled with high-tech machinery. Each canoe begins as a flat piece of plastic, shipped to Lewis in cardboard.
This is the material, and this is the Royal X. And as you see, all the colors are fused together, and that's done by a vulcanization process. So basically, they take all the layers, put them where they need to be, put these little strips in, and then they vulcanize it, which basically seals all the layers together.
He says these thin strips of colored material have a type of foam inside them. When the plastic is heated up, that foam makes the plastic expand and grow, both in length and width. That heating process happens in Lewis's shop in an oven that really looks no different than something you'd see at a pizzeria.
So what you're looking at here is about 20 foot length in the oven, and it's about 5.5 or so feet wide. This tray actually rolls in and out. And so we put the plastic on the rack, and then when it's done doing its thing, we pull it out.
Pull it out with welder's gloves, since the now larger sheet of plastic is about 300 degrees. It's a two-person operation to slide the canoe in progress from the oven onto a molding table. Lewis and his brother Bill schedule certain days when they can both be at the shop to build the canoes. What happens next has to take place in about a minute's time because the plastic is cooling rapidly and after about 60 seconds will be impossible to mold. A large single piece of metal, the mold, is raised. The plastic is fitted over two fixtures Lewis calls his helpers. They resemble a person's knee. They've been warmed with a propane torch so they can help the hot material keep its heat for a few seconds longer. After securing the sheet with some metal clamps, the clock is still ticking, the mold is lowered.
So we come back down, we put that in place, and then it's basically held in position. The mold, at this point, my brother and I kind of have our jobs that we do. Goes back down, and as you can see this line all over on the tabletop, that's where the plastic gets pinched, all out along the edge.
What happens next is a mixture of vacuum pressure and hands-on work to form the basic shell of what will be a canoe. After a cooling period, excess plastic is trimmed with a router. Later, benches, seats, and other features will be added by hand, each canoe attended to individually. Most of this later work can be done by Lewis in his shop by himself, though his canine companions, Lily and Casey, sometimes provide moral support. Business has been good for Two Brothers Canoe, a testament perhaps to the quality of their product. Most of the business, Lewis says, has come from word of mouth and Facebook. He's had the opportunity to see his canoes float by him on a river, and during our visit, he was finishing a canoe for a customer in Little Rock and already thinking about beginning work on another for a customer who had called from Jonesboro. For a business Lewis didn't think about until a random conversation with his older brother, things are going pretty well. He says most members of his family and most of his friends have been impressed.
You know, I think everybody was real supportive. You know, I've always kind of been a dreamer. So I think a lot of people said, yeah, Lewis is the next harebrained idea, you know. So I think it took a little bit for people to take us serious.
Slowly, the brothers are building a reputation and getting some recognition for their canoes. And Lewis is working in a field he's always loved. When asked a common question, what advice would you give others contemplating beginning their own business? He says he wanted to avoid a cliched answer.
Just follow your dreams and your passions. But, you know, I really think life is about finding happiness, you know, and the things that you enjoy that you could, now talking business sense, that you could turn into a business, you know, it makes it a lot easier to do something when you really, truly enjoy it, so... follow your dreams, I guess, you know, but I didn't want to be that cliche answer, but there is a lot of truth to that.
Lewis Shaw is one of the two brothers of Two Brothers Canoe Incorporated, and we talked to him at his shop outside of Avoca, not too far from the left turn at the Crush Culvert earlier this week. You can learn more at the Two Brothers Canoe Facebook page or at their website, twobrotherscanoe.com.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. In just a few minutes on Weekend Ozarks, we'll celebrate a quiet Sunday morning with our weekly montage, and Becca Martin Brown takes us out for Sunday lunch.
But first, a few notes. The Symphony of Northwest Arkansas has announced auditions for the Sona Singers, a group of the region's best choral singers. The ensemble is led by director Terry Hicks, one of Arkansas's most respected choral conductors. The Sona Singers serve as the anchor of the larger Sona Chorale, which performs choral masterworks with the symphony, conducted by Sona Music Director Paul Haas. The 2013-2014 repertoire, to include Brahms' Requiem and other works, to be announced at the first rehearsal. Rehearsals will be held weekly on Sunday afternoons. The audition dates are September 28th, a Saturday, and October 1st, a Tuesday. You can learn more by sending an email to Terry Hicks at thehicks14all@me.com.
We may ask Tim to put that on the web.
I think so.
That's a hard one to remember. The Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education at the University of Arkansas will begin its new Diverse Perspectives Dialogue Series with a panel discussion titled Trayvon Martin in Review, Messages for Today's America. The conversation and open forum begins 5:30 Tuesday evening in the Arkansas Union Theater on the UA campus. Organizers say the program is intended to promote healthy dialogue surrounding the issues involved in the Trayvon Martin case. Charles Robinson, the Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Community at the University, will moderate discussion. Panelists scheduled to be involved include Corey Anderson, who's Vice President of the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, Patsy Watkins, a professor of journalism at the U of A, Laurent Sakharov, an assistant professor of law, Leon Jones, a criminal defense attorney, and Ron Harris, founder and president of the organization A Level Up. That's Tuesday evening at 5:30.
Jackie Crabtree, the mayor of Pea Ridge, Thursday announced the annual Pea Ridge Mule Jump. It will be held Saturday, October 12th at the Pea Ridge Old Stadium on Black Street in Pea Ridge. Last year, more than 6,000 attended this unique event. 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people. A 5K run will start the day's activities at 7:30 a.m. from the Old Stadium at Black Street Stadium in Pea Ridge. Opening ceremonies begin at the stadium at 9 a.m. Following opening ceremonies, a full day of events, including the halter class, that's a mule beauty pageant, barrel and flag races, pole bending, and the mule jumping competition will begin. The jump draws contestants from a 6-state area.
Yep, I've been there. It's a lot of fun. All right, so we've gone from the Sona Singers to a mule jump, now to Crystal Bridges, who says it's not a varied world we live in. Crystal Bridges will host a concert Friday night, October 4th, from 6:30 until 8. The New York City-based Cassatt String Quartet will present a unique musical exploration of Mary Cassatt, including the original composition, Mary Cassatt, Scenes from Her Life. It was commissioned by the UCA College of Fine Arts and Communication and composed by Bruce Adolph, Quizmaster of Performance Today's Piano Puzzlers. He'll be present at the concert to introduce the piece. So that's happening October 4th, just been announced recently. The concert will be accompanied by projected images of Cassatt's paintings and followed by a question and answer period with Bruce and members of the quartet. Admission, $10 for the public, free for members. More information available at crystalbridges.org.
Growing up on North Sassafras Hill Road, east of Fayetteville, and returning to live in my childhood home 5 years ago, I have driven past Sun's Chapel on Highway 45 most days of my life. Though I have admired it from afar, I had never stopped to explore the grounds, peeked in a window, or stepped foot inside this little rock church.
We're a little sad that so many people go by here and have never been in.
Until Tuesday, when Tricia Beeland showed me around.
So here is our chapel. Seats about 100. We have had to replace pew covers and rugs, but otherwise it's very much like it was originally.
Originally, when Sun's Chapel was completed in 1939. Tricia Beeland is the historian for a group of women called the Rural Builders, started by four women with the main purpose of building this chapel 91 years ago. History says this land was once owned by the Sun family in the mid to late 1800s. There was a chapel of sorts, a wooden building on the edge of the cemetery across the street, though the date of its demise is unknown. Clearly, before 1922, the date that the women in the community came together to begin raising money for construction of the current chapel.
And they were farm women. They did what they knew how to raise money, which was make quilts and sell them, have little craft get-togethers. They made lunches and sold them at cattle auctions. They put on dramatic performances and charged some amount of money. And 1922, it took them until 1939 to actually finish the building because there was a world war, there was a depression, and their husbands did a lot of the labor. They had to hire a few local craftsmen. But a building doesn't like go up as quickly as they do now.
Nor do the costs compare. With $1,400, after 10 years of fundraising, construction began. A formal plaque nested in among the brown and gray rock on the northeast corner of the chapel commemorates its dedication in 1940.
Sun's Chapel, conceived by the Rural Builders Club, 1922, quoted, "With the Lord's help and our husbands, we can and will do it." Chapel completed 1939, and the cornerstone is in memory of David Robert Henson, 1921-1991, the Henson family were early residents of the area, and his daughter, Linda Lilly, Henson Lilly, was a longtime member and officer and died within the last few years.
The colorful stained glass with the dove that makes up the top portion of the front window of the chapel was donated by the Henson family. Back inside, if you look out this same window, you'll see a tall and sprawling sycamore tree that is as old as the chapel itself. The church is and always has been non-denominational and never actually held church services, though Sunday school was held each Sunday until 1996.
The community used to come have an adult Sunday school upstairs, children's Sunday school downstairs, and then be released in time to drive into town to go to the church of their choice. Buddy Crouch, who is just recently deceased, was the last one.
The pulpit, about 30 feet across from that stained glass window, held a buzzer for the adults to alert the children in the basement that they were finished with their studies. The 20 or so pews are showing their years, as is the brown particle board that makes up the walls and ceilings. Belin says that it's no longer made, and it's expensive to have it repaired or replaced. Two original light fixtures of gold and clouded glass hang over either side of pews, in between ceiling fans that were later installed. Though a gas furnace was put in during original construction, air conditioning was just recently installed. Sun's Chapel has about 10 weddings per year, and brides are not as inclined to stand in the heat in their attire as they once were. Weddings are just one way that the rural builders raise money to maintain the church. As the group is still active, fundraising and upkeep are its main goals. And keeping with the tasks of the original members, a second way they earn dollars is with quilt sales. Every Tuesday morning, hence the day of my visit, a group of 20 or so ladies meet in the basement of the chapel to quilt.
Have a seat right here and go just visit. I'm Jeanette Loris. We quilt to raise money.
This is Liz.
And Eloise.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
We're the fundraising group for the chapel. And we basically do it, the quilts, we quilt. Most of them are hand embroidered. Some of them are machine embroidered, but very low percentage. We sell the quilts, and this has been an ongoing fundraiser for probably about 20 years. And it also brings in many new members, so.
Though knowing how to quilt is quite helpful, it isn't a requirement for joining Rural Builders. Jeanette learned when she joined, and though Tricia tried to learn, they made her the historian. Embroidering the centerpiece for a baseball-themed quilt is Susie Shelton McCray, a third-generation rural builder.
My grandmother was one of the four ladies that started the Rural Builders Club 90 years ago. They decided that we needed a church in the neighborhood. And they raised every penny. Some of the men helped with the work, but the women raised all the money that went into it.
Her grandmother lived right down the hill on Shelton Road. Susie was 8 when her family moved there. She fondly remembers Sunday school and other community events held at the chapel. The site also held a one-room school from 1890 until 1949, when it was moved down the other side of the hill and turned into a residence. Susie attended that school for the 3rd, 4th, 5th, and part of the 6th grade. She was also the first bride to marry in the chapel in 1948. And though she lived elsewhere for 60 years, she returned here every year, even embroidering from her home in Wichita Falls, Texas. She came back for good almost 3 years ago. Emerging from the historian's collection is a black and white photo.
This is my mom. This is my grandmother. And that's Mrs. Robinson, who was one of the four. And that's Mrs. Brazil, who was one of the four. And I have Mother's little sailor hat. I collect hats. So this is our, when we celebrated our anniversary. And I think that was just last year. So, and that's me, so.
The chapel earned a spot on the National Register for Historic Places in 2003 and recently became a 501c3. Fundraising efforts are underway for a landscaping project in conjunction with the University of Arkansas School of Architecture in anticipation of a celebration in 2015 for the 75th anniversary of the dedication of Sun's Chapel. In addition to quilting, weddings, and memorial services. The Rural Builders for Sons Chapel hold a donation-based soup lunch the third Tuesday of each month. And trust me, it's well worth the visit.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellum.
I'm Christina Thomas.
This has been Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue Rally Time in Northwest Arkansas.
It has.
So that is a louder-than-usual weekend.
Especially here in the KUAF studios, yes. Right in the middle of downtown.
And it's not just motorcycles, either. I walked outside to go to lunch on Friday, and there was a helicopter overhead. It's just a louder-than-usual weekend.
Until this morning.
Because we're going to celebrate, not that there's anything wrong with loud and bikes and helicopters, but we're going to celebrate the end of all of this by saluting silence and quiet in our Sunday montage.
There are questions to be asked, and it is time for you to do so. Here in this fortress of solitude, we shall try to find the answers together.
That door.
I think a screw fell out of it.
It just closed, sir.
Who?
She doesn't talk, sir.
What do you want?
I want to talk to you.
I'm busy.
What are you doing?
Reading.
South America, land of wealth and promise.
Very interesting.
Let's get out of here. I said, let's get out of here. I want to talk to you.
That castle.
No one lives there.
Then who is your lord?
We don't have a lord.
What? I told you, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Order? Who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
Why do you whisper green grass? Why tell the trees what ain't so? Whispering grass, the trees don't have to know.
Fishing is finished there entirely. Now tell me this, Yank, what is it you're after? Is it trout or salmon?
All I want is to get to Innisfree.
Ah, now you're talking sense. The best fishing in the country.
Too far you there, Mr. Costello.
Trout is always your eye.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain.
To see if you correctly identified the 10 clips in this morning's montage, visit our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com.
Good morning. It is Sunday, September 22nd. It's autumn 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Becca Martin Brown, features editor of Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, every weekend in What's Up, we feature a restaurant.
Yes, you do.
Yummy.
And they're not, we've developed something of a formula. They don't have to be new, but our assistant editor, Kevin Kinder, likes the trendy new stuff. Mm-hmm. Ashley Batchelor, one of our reporters, really likes any place that serves dessert.
Okay.
And I like the good old-fashioned Sunday drive to lunch. And if there's history to go with it, I'm even happier.
Right.
So I found a place that I wanted to tell you about.
So this is one of your places.
This is one of my places. This place is in Goshen.
Is it the cafe? You know, I wanted to go there for a long time, so I'm anxious to hear this report.
Me too.
Schoolhouse
Cafe.
Yep.
And I have wanted to, every time I drove through, I was driving. Well, you can't really stop and write down the name and the phone number, or you shouldn't, you know, while you're driving. So I was finally riding, and I got to write down the phone number and met the really nice people who own it, Rusty and Ruthie Stroud. Mm-hmm. It was obviously the schoolhouse from the 1920s to about the 1940s, and they have class pictures up.
Wow.
So you can see those. They have beautiful yellow pine tongue and groove walls, which are not original, but the beadboard ceiling is. It's this beautiful, quaint little place, and they knew nothing about running a restaurant, like so many people. Like the nice Rivertown barbecue people who knew nothing about running a restaurant.
Let me just put in here that if you're listening and you want to run a restaurant and you know nothing about it, the odds that you're going to succeed are low, right?
Oh, yeah.
People do. But it's a lot of hard work. But these people have.
They're about 2 years into it. They had to completely clean up the building. There was an original schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. There was the schoolhouse from the 1920s mm-hmm. that was on part of that original foundation. Then a Masonic lodge had it. And so there were dropped ceilings, and they covered up all the windows and, you know, all those sorts of things that happen to a building when it's modernized. So they tore all of that out. It's this beautiful place. And a lot of the recipes, of course, have their own history that were handed down in the family.
So they do know how to cook.
They do know how to cook, and that was the fun part. They do homemade pie. Coconut cream, pecan, chocolate, fruit pies. They do fish dinners on Friday and Saturday night and Sunday after church, which is why I'm telling you about this today. And the dinners come with hush puppies, a baked potato or fries, coleslaw, brown beans. Yeah.
Catfish.
Just what you'd want. Just what you'd want.
Although there's this thing about you can't call it catfish unless it's American grown.
Yeah.
So it's fish.
Okay.
Go figure. They have breakfast starting at 10 in the morning.
On Sundays?
Every day.
Okay.
With skillets and omelets, and they have a lunch special, and they have, I haven't had one yet, but I plan to, bacon-stuffed burgers.
Okay.
So that's your tip for the day. Schoolhouse Cafe, 10 to 3, Sunday through Thursday, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Saturday and Sunday in Goshen, and you can find out more at 444-6500. And if you're still running away from Bikes and Songs, you can run to Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park this afternoon for Civil War Collections with Ann Webb and Steve Burgess from 1 to 5. Mm-hmm. That is, of course, free. Or you can run to the Clayton House Museum in Fort Smith.
Trains, right?
Railroad History, Mike Condren. That starts at 2. You should call ahead.
That's what I was going to suggest.
783-3000. This is a fairly new series. But about a year now.
Yeah, but it's been met with great success.
Popular as all get out. So there you go. Have a great Sunday.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On the next Fresh Air Weekend, Linda Ronstadt talks about her long singing career and the Parkinson's disease, which she recently revealed has made it impossible to sing. Also, Jeff Gwynn discusses his new biography of Charles Manson. It describes Manson's upbringing, how he fashioned himself into a cult leader, his obsession with getting a record deal, and why he and his followers committed gruesome murders. Join us.
Fresh Air Weekend begins this Sunday evening at 6 on KUAF Public Radio.
Fayetteville-based blues and soul artist Corey Montgomery recently stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF. And in addition to other songs, he played this one.
All right, this song's called, it's a Willis Allen Ramsey song called Satin Sheets. Wish I was a millionaire, play rock music and grow long hair. I tell you, boys, I'd buy a new Rolls Royce. pretty women, they call to me. Give them all the third degree. I give them satin sheets to keep them off the streets. But hallelujah, what's it to you? Praise the Lord and Pastor Miss Lane. Great Jehovah, won't you come over? As soon as you see me boogie woogie on the silver screen. Yeah. Hang 'em high or hang 'em low, or put 'em in the ceilings wherever I go, and they'll swing all night in the rafter light. Well, hallelujah, what's it to you? Well, you got your coffee, me, I got my Spanish tea. Great Jehovah, won't you come over? As soon as you see me boogie woogie on the silver screen. Wish I was a millionaire, play rock music and grow long hair. And I tell you boys, I'd buy a new Rolls Royce.
For a concert calendar or more information, visit CoreyMontgomeryBand.com.
Schumann's Symphony in D minor was first written in 1841, but not published until 1851. That was in a revised version insisted upon by Clara Schumann as the symphony her husband intended. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of the KUAF Sunday Symphony, 7 to 9 p.m. Sunday nights right here on KUAF. Join me for the original 1841 version of Schumann's Symphony in D minor, praised by Brahms. That's coming up 7 to 9 Sunday night right here on KUAF.
KUAF is supported by Cisco Funeral Chapel, with roots in Northwest Arkansas since 1915. Cisco offers a variety of funeral services, including pre-arrangement and life insurance policies. More information, commonly asked questions, healing resources, and honor a veteran information available online at ciscofuneral.com.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Clyde.
Clyde?
Yes.
Why Clyde? Any particular reason?
Well, I visited Cane Hill on Friday morning, and the guy I interviewed told me about Clyde. It's just a few miles, I believe, west of Cane Hill.
So toward Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's not a lot of room between Cane Hill and Oklahoma.
I mean, I'm assuming it's teeny tiny. But yeah. Evidently, I did a story on the Cane Hill College.
Right.
And the women's college was in Clyde.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And And that college is long gone.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But if that college still existed in Clyde and they had a sports team, you know what they would have to be, what the mascot would have to be?
I don't. Tell me.
The Bonnies.
Oh, okay.
I get it. I thought by the lack of your hysterical laughter, you didn't understand.
I was trying to figure out how it would go. The Clyde's Bonnies, the Bonnie.
Right.
All right.
Okay. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
You're back tomorrow at noon with a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.
I am.
Antoinette and I will have Tuesday show. You and I back together on Thursday.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much for listening.
Until then, have a good Sunday.